Which country will lead the global economy in 2012?
And which will follow?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Jeremy Hobson. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, December 30th.
Happy Friday, Adrienne.
Thank you. You too.
Coming up, how the end of the war in Iraq changes U.S. oil policy.
And New York's big investment in New Year's.
Of course. Plus, the role of weather in the upcoming Iowa caucuses.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We've got news today that Spain's government will cut more than $11 billion next year and raise taxes. China's slowing a little too, at least in manufacturing. Here in the U.S., as we'll hear in just a minute, new economic data is a little more promising. To help us make sense of which country is going to drive things next year, we've got Jack Ablin. He's the chief investment officer at BMO Harris Private Bank. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Adrian.
So how does the economic situation here in the U.S. affect the global economy?
Well, we are experiencing some growth, and believe it or not, we are probably the beacon of growth for the world right
now. The bright spot, huh?
Yeah, like it or not, that's where we are.
And on the flip side, how does the economic situation in the rest of the world affect our economy?
Well, as you know, we're pretty much all in it together. We've got globalization and free trade and a lot of financial transactions, linking the globe pretty closely together. So what happens in Europe certainly matters. What happens in China and other places certainly matters. So it's, I think it's probably not a huge surprise that headlines that are coming across the seas are impacting our markets on a day-to-day basis.
Which countries are you watching especially closely right now?
I think really the two areas of primary concern for me are the Eurozone, which collectively is really the essentially the biggest economy in the world, matches evenly with the U.S., but also China, which is the second largest economy in the world. Here, we certainly know the troubles in Europe. It's a debt overhang, and now countries are grappling with trying to reduce their debts, but also cut spending and austerity programs. But in China, which has been a phenomenal growth story over the last decade or so, what we find is that they're starting to slow, and we have to see how slow the China growth story is going to become.
Jack Ablin from Harris Private Bank, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, today's the last stock trading day of the year. What happens by close of business or by the closing bell will cement the tepid yet improving economic conditions we've seen in the last year. So instead of going into too much detail about what kind of year it's been for the global economy, let's get a preview of what we can expect in 2012. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch, and she's with us now from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So we're wrapping up the year, and there were some signs of economic optimism in the last few weeks. What do those things say about the coming year?
Well, I'm looking back at the year and I say, wow, it was a really rough first half. I mean, growth was less than 1%.
Yeah.
And, third quarter up 1.8%. And maybe even the year ended pretty strong at 3%, maybe even higher. But, I look ahead at 2012 and I'm looking at growth more like 2 to 2.5%. And, that's lower than the long-term growth rate for the country. So I'll take growth when it's compared to recession for sure. I just would like it to be a bit stronger.
A bit stronger. All right. So if the growth rate, Jill, is going to be so modest, what does that say about the jobs picture? I mean, that continues to be the one thing that everyone's focused on, right?
Yes, and I think I'm going to use your mantra, tepid but improving. That's what we can put in the jobs category. Weekly claims have been showing some improvement. It does bode better for next year. But again, with growth at 2 or 2.5%, it's really hard to see the impetus for employers to add a lot of new jobs. I suspect over the course of next year, the unemployment rate's going to drift a little lower, maybe between 8 and 8.5%. But you know what? Historically, that's awfully high. And for the 13 million folks who are out of work, it ain't strong enough.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And you know, it's amazing, Jill, the economy is so interwoven, right? We talk about the growth rate and how that affects the jobs market. And if people can't get jobs, then how are they going to, like, say, buy houses? I mean, can the housing market recover?
Well, the housing market really is the epicenter, and that continues to be a problem. The market has essentially moved sideways to slightly lower from a very low level. Now, here's the important thing to remember about housing. House prices doubled between the years 2000 and 2006.
Yeah.
7 years doubling of prices was unprecedented. I think it's going to take about the same amount of time for us to have a full recovery, and that's putting us into 2013 or 14 before we get to a more normal housing market.
And quickly, Jill, these are all things, of course, we can easily see, if not predict. So what are the unknowns? What could really derail all of this?
Well, obviously, events in Europe could cause great uncertainty, but that's the known boogeyman. I think the unknown one is the ones that maybe might catch us by surprise. Think back, Japanese earthquake and tsunami, yeah. Arab Spring, U.S. debt ceiling, something will surprise us next year.
And Jill Schlesinger joining us from New York as she does every Friday.
Well, Steve, here in the U.S., we've heard about and felt inflation, rising food prices and gas prices and prices of things we don't usually spend a lot of time thinking about, like cotton.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as the year winds down, inflation seems to be slowing a bit. For more about why that matters, we turn to Chris Farrell. He's Marketplace's economics correspondent. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So where are we with inflation right now?
Well, as you know, there's lots of numbers that touch on inflation, but just to highlight a few, consumer price index, producer price index, the personal consumption expenditure index, they're all showing that the inflation gauges are relaxing. They're coming down in the second half of the year as we enter into 2012.
And how does that, and maybe how should it play into policy decisions right now?
I think one thing that's going to play into, I don't know about you, but, you know, the sort of criticism of the Fed has been kind of muted.
Mm-hmm.
So it might make it easier for the president. He's nominated two people to take empty seats on the Federal Reserve. Might be easier to get those nominations through. I think that it gives the Federal Reserve a lot more room to maneuver in terms of keeping interest rates low and then perhaps embracing some sort of program to provide some support to the economy in 2012. So basically, it's a more relaxed atmosphere, gives the Fed room to maneuver, gives some support to the economy.
And how does it matter to me and you?
Well, it matters in a lot of ways. First of all, I don't think it's quite coincidence that we've had an improvement in consumer confidence as the inflation numbers come down. I mean, people really hate inflation. I mean, the fact is, when inflation is high and rising, your dollar just doesn't buy as much. So we feel a little better with low inflation. The other thing is, the Federal Reserve is the only game in town. So with all the problems in Europe, the questions about will the Eurozone crack up in 2012 or not, you know, will this economy gain traction, the Federal Reserve has room to maneuver with low interest rates and with low inflation.
Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Well, Chris and Adrian, it's college application season. Don't you remember?
I am so glad to be done with that.
Yes, we're all done with it. Thank goodness. But, oh boy, I remember how hectic it was trying to wrap up all the paperwork and get it all in. You know, most colleges have deadlines coming up in the next month or so. And after a few years of record applications, things may be slowing down at some schools. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Colleges have welcomed, often invited, the recent flood of applicants. The more students they turn down, the more selective they look. But it's also harder to predict which students will accept an offer of admission. Michael Bernstein is provost of Tulane University in New Orleans. He says in the last few years, Tulane got so many applications, its admission staff was overwhelmed. So this year, the school added an extra essay to its application.
Our goal was to increase the amount of information we have and to discourage the less than serious applicant.
Other forces may shrink the application pool at many private colleges this year. Barmak Nasirian represents college admissions officers.
The slowdown has lasted long enough that people are beginning to have pretty significant misgivings about paying for private school tuition.
Nasirian says public universities will benefit. Though their tuition is rising faster, students still see them as a more affordable choice. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
There's been more violence in Iraq over the past 24 hours. The latest attack was in Kirkuk, which is about 2 hours north of Baghdad, when a roadside bomb went off, injuring three people there. And the violence has ramped up since the last of American troops left the country this month.
The war was certainly divisive here at home, and whatever your opinion, oil played a pivotal role. So how is the oil business in Iraq today compared to the start of the war? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
When we invaded in 2003, Saddam's Iraq was an OPEC underachiever. Its companies were low-tech, and it faced UN sanctions. Analyst Bhushan Bari is with IHS Cambridge Energy.
Production during the 90s depended on how much the United Nations was going to allow Iraq to export. And Iraq couldn't buy a lot of equipment and so forth, given the restrictions it had.
Removing Saddam meant possibly more crude from a place with lots of it. Michael Makovsky at the Bipartisan Policy Center used to do Iraq oil issues at the Pentagon.
Iraq's potential in energy is immense. So if there is political stability, the overall trajectory for Iraqi energy is very bullish.
If. The problem is not what's underground, it's the above-ground issues. Insecurity, attacks on oil facilities, and politics. The new Iraq gave international oil companies tough terms, meaning small profits, says oil analyst Robin Mills in Dubai.
It had a long tradition of running its own oil affairs, and it was politically very important for the Iraqi government to be able to say, look, we're not giving away our oil to foreigners.
Mediocre terms attracted firms from places like China, Malaysia, Angola, and Russia. To Makovsky, it's not exactly been a bonanza for the invading country's companies.
For those who thought the U.S. went into Iraq for oil, that's been a loser, right, if that was the case, because the U.S. companies have not been getting the greater share of the deals.
Iraq's production has grown to 3 million barrels per day, and Bari at IHS thinks that could double in a decade, which is good for consumers, because global supplies are now tight. And
something's always going wrong somewhere, either because of acts of God, nature, accidents, or political issues.
So you could argue we squeezed out some energy security from the Iraq adventure. What you cannot argue is that Iraq's oil revenue paid for its reconstruction, as was once advertised. That $50 billion came from you and me. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
China has unveiled plans for space exploration over the next 5 years. The country says it's going to launch space laboratories, manned spaceships, and an eventual goal, Adrian, of building a space station and putting a man on the moon. I think
very
we've heard
interesting,
these plans before from another country. I'm trying to think of, Andrew Lung is a Chinese business consultant who's with us now from Hong Kong. And Andrew, good morning to you. Hey there.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. So what's China going to be spending and building on space exploration in the next few years?
Yes, China has just launched its five-year space plan and is actually trying to follow the footstep of the United States, you know, sort of harking back to the days when the first American was on the moon somewhere in 1969. But it's not a massive amount because China is trying to do it gradually. So China is trying to catch up and trying to build a stronger nation, as it were.
Do you think this is motivated as a way, I don't know, to increase the country's prestige, or is this more about the economy or science and technology programs?
I don't think it's just prestige because you look at America's space program, it did have a lot of very useful spin-off for application in different types of research and also into industry, into business. So I think that this is very much a way China to build up its development model as a more advanced nation.
Andrew Lung, international and independent China specialist. Andrew, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, Steve, Mother Nature often gets a say in elections. Bad weather can reduce turnout. So we wanted to know how the weather could change the outcome in this Tuesday's caucus in Iowa. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ginzer joins us now to explain. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Adrian.
So how could the weather impact turnout and the result of the Iowa caucus?
Adrian, you could say that gale force winds blow a lot harder than campaign bluster. Campaign watchers say really bad weather can skew the race toward the candidate with the most dedicated followers. Elderly voters and the less committed supporters tend to stay home if it's snowing. The Des Moines Register has researched this and didn't find a connection between weather and turnout unless the weather is really bad. I talked to American University history professor Alan Lichtman this morning about this. He says a blizzard would be a boon to Texas Congressman Ron Paul because he's got lots of young, eager supporters.
I think there are people willing to put on their boots and trudge through 6 feet of snow for Ron Paul. I'm not sure there are that many willing to do that for any other candidate.
And do campaigns have to change the way they spend money depending on the weather?
Yeah, Lichtman says they have to spend more money if the weather is lousy. They might have to rent four-wheel drive vehicles and hire extra drivers to get voters to the caucuses, maybe beef up their phone banks and make extra calls to make sure voters show up. But right now, it looks like the candidates are not going to have to do that. The forecast is calling for clear skies for caucus day, above-average temperatures, and that means the less committed voters will show up. Aides for Mitt Romney say a bigger turnout would benefit him. We'll see.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Speaking of weather and speaking of Iowa, Adrian, crows have been inundating the skies of Iowa City.
It sounds ominous.
It does. Crows are usually not the bird you want to see because there's usually something really bad at the end of the crow's venture. You know, they're going to do something.
Well, especially if you're using the word inundation. That's a lot of crows,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. Well, it's been a little warmer than usual. There hadn't been a whole lot of snow in Iowa, at least in Iowa City thus far. And the crows have been causing big headaches below for shoppers and businesses at an outdoor mall there. So the city of Iowa City is doing something about the foul problem. It's not an elaborate thing. It's nothing high tech. It's just a bunch of yellow balloons.
And that scares off crows?
Well, the city's putting these balloons in the trees at the shopping center. And what they're doing is they're making these balloons look like eyes.
Creepy.
So they're taking red and black markings and they're putting them on these balloons, simulating what the crows would think were the big eyes of owls or other predatory birds. Ooh, that would scare me away, too.
Now, are the crows afraid of this? Do we know yet?
We don't know if it's going to work, although it has worked in the past. If the balloons don't work, Adrian, the temperature is about to drop into the teens later this weekend, probably 12 or 13 degrees by Monday night. So that's going to certainly give the crows the ultimate cold shoulder. All right, get the resolutions ready and the champagne chilled because New Year's Eve, Adrian, is almost here.
You
know,
I'm excited.
Tomorrow is New Year's Eve.
And I'm excited.
Are you really? Do you have, like, big plans?
I have no plans at all. And that's part of what makes it so exciting.
Really?
Absolutely.
You just, like, I mean, I was always the person who would, like, celebrate. I was thinking, if I really celebrated New Year's Eve, then the next year, the following year, is just going to be spectacular, right? One year I was sick. I remember. Actually, that was last year. I do remember that. But this year was really great anyway, so I guess there was really no correlation. Well, the top destination this year, according to Priceline.com, for people who are traveling for New Year's, is none other than New York City, where they drop that crystal
Makes
ball
sense
every year,
to me.
Right? The Big Bash in New York is a big investment, but it also has some serious payoffs, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains.
Whether you're at a fabulous party sipping Cristal or on your couch in a Snuggie, chances are you'll be counting down the last seconds of 2011 with Dick Clark in Times Square.
3, 2, 1, Happy New Year!
The event costs millions, from the big police presence to the fireworks to the musical acts, Justin Bieber and Lady Gaga this year. Jeffrey Strauss is president of Countdown Entertainment, which produces the Times Square New Year's Eve event. He says it's money well spent. A billion people tune in.
This year we'll be live on CCTV in China. You'll see it in Europe. You'll see it in South America. And that is an advertisement, a promotion to come and visit New York City.
Hundreds of thousands of tourists come for the big night and spend $24 million on hotels, meals, and event tickets. Strauss says being there is priceless.
the mayor pushes the crystal button and we begin to count down, and the whole, I mean, you can feel it. It's tremendous.
This was a record-setting year for tourism in New York. 50 million people visited the city. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Sunday, we're about to turn the page on our current calendar, but researchers from Johns Hopkins believe that the new calendar we're putting up on the wall may be wrong. They say the way our current calendar is laid out makes Americans inefficient.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we ask, should we tweak the calendar to boost business? Here to talk with us is Steve Hanke, one of the researchers working on the project. He's with us from Baltimore. Good morning, sir.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's so wrong with the calendar we have now? Why should we change it?
Well, the problem is that every year, dates, of course, are always the same year after year, but the days change. So this creates big scheduling problems. And if you take even at a university, every year you have to decide, when is the semester starting? When is it ending? When are the vacations going to be? If you had a permanent calendar that we're proposing, each quarter has 3 months in it. And the first 2 months in each quarter in our calendar have 30 days, and the last month has 31. And it just keeps going like that forever. So we know in our permanent calendar that Dick Henry and I have developed, April 15th, just for example, I mean, that's a day people pay attention to.
Oh, yeah.
That April 15th would always be on a Sunday forever.
And Christmas would always be on the same day, and the 4th of July would always be on the same day?
4th of July would be on Wednesday.
So our birthdays would be the same day, all of them.
Yes, yes. So this calendar would be set up like that, and then there is a seasonal drift in a calendar, and that's why we have in our current calendar leap year. And in ours, every 5 or 6 years, there would be an extra week added, 7 days, at the end of the month of December. You can think of that as kind of a adult spring vacation with pay, of course.
Yes, please,
yeah,
sign
with
me
pay,
up.
Pay, of course, yes. Yeah.
We haven't gotten into naming what that extra week would be, or let's just say week X.
Week X,
We don't want to get into controversy over naming it.
But give me some examples of how would this actually help business.
Think of it this way. With the days in the current calendar system floating around and being on different dates every year, you do have these scheduling problems. So in large, it's a day count problem. And this comes into finance, the mathematics of finance, very much. So if you have a mortgage or a bond or a swap or, you know, sophisticated derivatives, this kind of thing, you have interest involved. And you have to be able to count the number of days to be able to determine the amount of interest that is involved in the financial instrument that you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And the problem with the current calendar is that there are 365 days in it. It makes calculations difficult. So these conventions, there are many, many conventions. If you get into calculating interest, the day count problem is a huge problem. But I've computed just on a very crude basis that probably the errors, the magnitude of the errors in calculating interest, it's probably running now in the bond market alone about $130 billion a year. And it's about the size of the annual GDP of a country like Hungary or Kuwait.
Hmm.
And you get also, think of the scheduling problems for business. When to have the holidays, how you get the right number of days people are supposed to be paid on a contract. All those things, once you figure it out, you're fixed with this permanent calendar. Now, with the days floating around, there are all kinds of errors. I mean, some years you have a lot more vacation days because of weekends than other years. Things like prescriptions, well, we don't have the same number of days in each month, and so there are lots of errors in prescriptions. You either get one too many or too few pills.
Right.
Think of the baseball season and scheduling all the events. Well, you'd just do this once. You wouldn't have to do it every year. You would know on July 4th the Baltimore Orioles were going to play in Baltimore on a Wednesday.
Hey, Steve, let me ask you a question. Have you talked to, like, the I don't know if there is such a thing like the World Calendar Bureau or Association.
Whoever decides
who decides these things? Who do you talk to about this?
Historically, the Pope has decided. So what we have to do, a little tongue-in-cheek here, but you know, an audience with the Pope would probably help a lot.
So off to the Vatican for Steve Hanke, one of the researchers working on this project, trying to perhaps change the calendar. Steve, good luck to you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, so thanks, Steve and Adrian. Bye.
And finally, Steve, have you ever forgotten your change at airport security?
Change? Yes, I have, actually. I've forgotten things before. I've forgotten shoes.
Wow.
I just started walking in my bare feet all the way to the gate, and then I'd be like, wait a second, something's wrong
here.
What is going on here?
Yeah. Well, it turned out lots of people forget change, and I understand why. I mean, you go through and you're trying to get dressed at the other end, and all these people are watching. It's stressful.
There's a line. You got to put your belt on and all that. Anxiety
producing.
You're being patted in different places.
So a few quarters, you know, they sometimes go missing.
Yeah.
It turns out it's a lot of quarters. In 2010, the total amount of change left at checkpoints was $376,480.39.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. That's a lot of money.
A third of $1 million.
Think about how big a piggy bank you'd need
be a huge piggy bank. So what are they going to do with those? I mean, are they going to like trying to reduce the deficit with it?
Or? They're not. Right now, TSA actually gets to keep all that money for its operating expenses.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that must be nice.
Yeah. But one legislator wants to, shall we say, change that.
Oh, no.
I know. Yeah. According to the LA Times, he's proposed a new rule that'd send that money over to the USO.
Oh, the USO, yeah.
Yeah, that supports programs for the military.
Exactly.
You see their signs. Or
overseas, absolutely. They do the tours, the entertainment tours for soldiers and troops. And
they have
Marines.
Things at airports for soldiers.
That's right.
And so he wants to send this money that we leave at the checkpoints over to them, which might make me feel a little bit better about forgetting those quarters.
About forgetting those quarters. And, you know, think about all the change. This is like the collective, like the national couch, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, think of all the quarters you find.
Just
like,
tip it upside down.
Yeah, just tip it upside down. Give it to the USO. Exactly.
In Los Angeles, I'm Adrian Hill.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. I hope you have a great new year. Enjoy 2012 as much as you've enjoyed 2011, huh?
And thanks for spending part of it with us.
Yeah, this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.